Talks and ideas. Robin has been very intensely interested in foundations of quantum theory and also in quantum information theory. He worked with Zurak on developing quantum Darwinism, and today he's going to talk to us about quantum knowledge.
Thank you very much, Owen. So if I hadn't had the introduction, then I would start out by saying, good morning, my name is Robin Blum-Cahote, and I'd like to quantize a caterpillar, which is why I've got a nice picture up here. Owen also covered a couple of basic background facts that you probably ought to know about me, one of which is I did my PhD with Wojciech Zurek, and the other of which is I work in the field of quantum information. And like all physicists, I have certain natural prejudices from what I've worked on and what I've studied and what I've done, and those will, I think, be evident in my talk. Those of you who are hardcore aficionados of other fields, I hope you will look at my talk with an open mind. The third thing that you should know is that, as Owen said, I do try to be entertaining. And so I am personally competing for the most flamboyant and provocative talk of the conference prize, although Ken Wharton is coming up later on, and he always competes in that category, but I get more time than he does. No. That's them. Jacob, this is God. Turn the volume down. Are we better? More? Yeah. The problem is I can easily cover this auditorium without the mic. All right. Is that better? Sorry, I'm loud. So, where was I there before I got interrupted? So I hope that despite my attempts to be highly entertaining, that you will not think that my silly slides mean that I have a silly point to make. Well, you can decide that, but don't conclude it just from the slides. Okay, so to start off with a bit of silliness, Rob Speckens told me that I really ought to emphasize the fact that in some sense I'm actually talking about quantum robots. Well, I'm not really going to talk about quantum robots a great deal, but if you have any ideas floating around in your head about quantum robots, by the way, this is what happens when you do a Google image search for a quantum robot. I don't know what the hell this is, but it's what came up. You also get some papers from the late 90s by Paul Benioff, not on images, but if you do a Google search, which, if you've read those, I will say they're not terribly relevant to what I'm going to talk about, although feel free to disagree with that in the question period. So moving on, let me give you a brief outline of what I'm going to say. I have a problem with quantum mechanics, don't we all? I also specifically have a problem with decoherence, don't we all? I may have different problems than you do, I'm not sure. I want to try to resolve these problems by arguing to you today that events may be contingent. If you ask, do measurements have to have definite outcomes? I want to argue that the answer is maybe not. I'm going to give you three examples, fairly concrete, and in the first two cases, simple examples to back up this rather crazy idea. The first is I want to demonstrate for you something called coherent measurements made by a device that gathers information about its surroundings without collapse. In other words, in a manner inconsistent with the very idea of collapse as a result of measurement. Secondly, I want to demonstrate the use of quantum knowledge, which is what you get from coherent measurements. And I want to demonstrate to you a device that wins bets, does something useful, using quantum information in a way that couldn't be done with classical information. And finally, and I apologize in advance for the fact that at this point, things are going to get a little bit technical. And so by this point, like a rocket going to the moon, I will have probably shed most of the audience. And I desperately hope that as many as possible of you are clinging by your fingernails when we get into representation theory. I'm going to give you what I think is the simplest full-fledged example of a quantum agent, something that gathers information about its environment, makes decisions with respect to its environment, and generally functions like, in some ways, us, but without ever experiencing collapse. I'm going to argue in conclusion that this really does provide a weird new perspective on quantum states, at least quantum states of knowledge. And we'll get to that later on. And then I'm going to conclude by trying to sum up why this might matter. Okay, yes? Oh, absolutely. I apologize. I'm not from the Discovery Institute. I'm from the Perimeter Institute. So I have a problem with quantum mechanics. What is my problem with quantum mechanics? Quantum mechanics consists of two elegant theories. We have a theory that I'll call the unitary part, beautifully designed, like the work of Apple. And this includes things like states in Hilbert space, density matrices, unitary evolution, completely positive maps, yada da yada da yada da, all that nice stuff. And over here, we have a theory that I call events. And this basically comes down to the quantum theory of measurement. When you make a measurement, you bring your apparatus, which is big and classical, into contact with your quantum system, and clunkety, 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 something happens. So why does something happen? Well, I don't know. But these two beautiful theories, each one of which has no physical content without the other, are bolted together by Born's rule to make a very successful, but horrifyingly to me, ugly theory. Okay, maybe you say, well, you know, screw aesthetics. It works, that's all we need. So here's my other problem. Given that the events part is necessary to fit experience and make predictions, which is kind of critical for science, and the unitary part is necessary to fit the correlations between successive events that we observe, now we have a theory, a fundamental theory, that is predicated on our experience. It specifically says, I will predict what you, the observer, is going to experience. And what bothers me about that is that that may be fine if you're trying to do particle physics and analyze electrons, but it's not okay if you want to think that this is a theory that could be built up to eventually analyze the inner workings of us. Because now I have a circularity, and I do not like that. This is my problem with quantum mechanics. Now, I also have a problem with decoherence. There's this question, if our world is actually quantum, if this really is a fundamental theory, why does it look classical? That begs the question, what the heck does that mean? Let me skip over that and say that, well, some people say decoherence is the answer. That's why it looks classical. Decoherence explains the appearance of the emergence of a classical world from a quantum substrate. Okay. So if that's the case, what would the world look like without decoherence? Surely if decoherence explains the emergence of classicality, then you could take away decoherence. What would you get? What would it look like? There are many answers to this. One is, we'd see the wave function. No, we wouldn't. This has so many problems with it. The answer that I would have given 5 years ago is nothing. And this is still a decent answer. The same mechanisms that cause decoherence allow us to observe things. Of course, we might tweak that and say it would be very hard to observe things. But when we did observe them, they would still look classical. I want to give you a different answer. It depends on the observer. It doesn't have to look classical. I think that decoherence means that effectively it does have to look classical. But if you take that away, then you have a couple of options. So here in a nutshell is the framework in which I want to resolve my problems. I want to take seriously this question of what would the world look like in the absence of decoherence. I put quotes around look like because, well, obviously if I just assume that the way that it looks is based on how things look to us and our kinds of observations, then I've already assumed the answer, right? It would look like everything else does because that's how we see things. So there are some obstacles to asking that question. The first is that you and I are very badly adapted to a world without decoherence because we've grown up in a world with an incredibly huge amount of decoherence. There are photons flying around. That's why you can see me. There are phonons flying around, and there are a lot of them. So I have no idea what this world would look like, but I can try to do some simple modeling of it. My solution is, in such a world, I want to imagine what a well-adapted critter would see. Okay, this begs another problem, which is how the heck do we know what it sees? And my answer to that is going to be behaviorist. I don't know what it sees, just as I don't know what you see. But I see what you're doing. You're looking at me. You're not sleeping. Ergo, I infer that you find this at least moderately interesting, or you just haven't gotten bored yet. But I've inferred something about what you appear to perceive, just based on your behavior. I'm going to do the same thing. This begs another question, which is, how would I see these things? And essentially what I'm going to argue, what I want to imagine here, is that we have this little pocket universe. And there's no decoherence in here. But maybe I'm sort of the god of this universe. I create it here, and then I close my eyes. I don't look at it. And I let things happen. And then I open my eyes again, and pow, right there, what do I see? Right? So what would I see if I ripped my way into this decoherence-free universe? And this would be unfortunate for the creatures that lived there. But, oh well, I created them. Screw them. This is kind of the apocalypse at the end. It's the final judgment. What will I see? So that's the question I want to ask in this talk. Okay, so here are my conclusions. Oh, I'm not done. I just want to tell you what the conclusions are so that you can start disagreeing with them now. Two questions. Do measurements or observations have to yield definite outcomes? Second question, could a different, possibly even better, more successful, more efficient kind of critter learn about its surroundings without having the subjective perception of events? If you were to be able to communicate with it and ask it, and you said, what happened? It would say, what the heck are you talking about? What do you mean nothing happened? Things don't happen? That didn't make any sense. I mean at a logical level. I think it made intuitive sense, but please don't try to analyze that last paragraph. Okay, my answers. First, no, I don't think that they have to yield definite outcomes. And second, yes, I think a different critter could perceive things in this radically different way. Let me try to put this in popular culture terms. You're in the Matrix. Okay, don't analyze that one too carefully either. I'm not arguing that we're in a computer simulation or aliens or machines or blah, blah, blah. What I am arguing is that what you're seeing is not precisely real, that you should be very skeptical about assigning absolute ontological reality to your perceptions. So if I told you that you were in the Matrix, as I just have, what would it take to convince you? Again, I'm following along the humorous pop culture line here. Well, one possibility would be you could see the underlying wave function or the hidden variables, if you're a Bohmian, directly, which would be pretty convincing. So here I am, I give you the red pill or the blue pill, you take the red pill, and voila, you see the underlying structure. This would be very convincing. Sorry. Another possibility would be if I could demonstrate to you that you can do things that you didn't think were possible. Now I think we're getting in more closer to the right track. So if I could show you how to have superpowers, this would be very convincing that you were in some kind of a world that's not like the one that you dreamt. No, sorry. It would be a much more exciting talk if I could tell you that. Okay. How about if you could see somebody else that had superpowers? Maybe that would be sufficiently convincing. So you're not Neo, but maybe these are the agents. Remember this from The Matrix? If you haven't seen The Matrix, I apologize for the fact that you're currently baffled. For the rest of you, these are these agents, right? They're internal to the computer program that runs The Matrix. And so they walk around looking very normal, but occasionally they do really crazy things. And just by seeing the agents, even if you were perfectly normal, you could be convinced that there was something really strange going on. So maybe I'm going to tell you where to look to see agents. No, sorry. They're not in this universe. The best that I can do is I can try to argue, not even prove is the wrong word here, that there is a Gedanken universe that I'll display for you in which there are agents, and I've used that word on purpose. There are agents that act, that perceive, and that effectively have superpowers. So, just to make it very clear, what I am going to try to show you is that if we had a decoherence-free universe, there could exist agents that would outperform at certain verifiable tasks any classical agent like you or me. And the conclusion that I'm going to draw from this, and you don't have to, is that our experience, even the experience that things actually happen, is not false, but it is a contingent feature of how and where we evolved. That we didn't grow up in a universe just like ours, but without decoherence. So I'm going to give you three examples. The first is a device or an agent that learns about its surroundings, but doesn't experience collapse. And this is what I call coherent measurement. The second is a device that uses quantum information to win bets at a greater rate than you could. And it's using what I call quantum knowledge. And finally, I'm going to try to jam all of this together and demonstrate an actual quantum agent. Of course, it would have to run in a universe without decoherence, which is called a quantum computer, right? A quantum computer is a little device that we have built and put inside a fantastically good Faraday cage so that it doesn't decohere. So that's what this is going to be. It's going to be an algorithm or a device that interacts with a very limited environment to do adaptive quantum data compression, for which it has to learn about its surroundings and also act on them. So at this point, before I get into the details, I'd like to give you some preemptive clarifications. These are the paradigms that I'm going to adopt. And this is a good slide to come back to in the question period if you disagree with any of my fundamentals. A measurement, it's pretty obvious, I think, at this point that I don't want to assume the canonical definition of a measurement because collapse is part of that. And I'm trying to argue that it doesn't need to have collapse. So operationally, a measurement is some interaction between an agent and some system of interest that gets knowledge for the agent. What is knowledge? Knowledge is a resource. It's basically information, but it has a purpose. You can use it to perform some task better. An agent, well, I think we all have an idea of what an agent is, but it's a simple mathematical model of some kind of a critter that might be considered to encapsulate some essential aspect of us. So in economics, they do a great deal of agent-based modeling. I've heard various other people at this conference use the term agent to represent something that gains knowledge, makes decisions. That's the sense in which I'm using it. I'm going to give you explicit models. A decision is an interaction between the agent and some system that is intended to accomplish some task. This is a little bit different from the definition of decision that most people use. So please think carefully about this. I am making no restrictions that, for instance, a decision is do this or do that. Because that implies definiteness. It implies that there are two choices. But if I give you a quantum system with two possibilities, there are immediately a whole bunch of other possibilities in between. So you think about that for 30 seconds, and you say, well, maybe I could make superpositions of decisions. And you think about that for a year, and you get really confused, and you do what I've done. But I want to point out that this is not your traditional decision. It's just some interaction intended to accomplish a task. A good decision is one that accomplishes the task well with high probability or gives you high utility in the expected case. And key thing, when I talk about things like expected utility and high probability, I am deeply sorry that I'm forced to come back to my experience. So let me tell you ahead of time, I am not going to be able to take myself completely out of this. Right? At the end of the day, I'm going to say what I observe at some point in the far future, and I have to assume Born's rule and all the other stuff in order to do that. But the point of this exercise is much like von Neumann's in constructing the Voigt-Neumann chain. It's to push the observer as far out as I can, and I think I'm going in an orthogonal direction to the direction that von Neumann pushed it. Yes? Okay, good. I'm sorry, I thought I had put Ask up there. Essentially, every measurement that I can make in the future and every valuation I can put on the outcomes of that measurement corresponds to a task. So I could say, your task is to put this object over here, and then later I'll measure its position, and I'll give you a score based on how close you got, And that, so the measurement really defines the task. The task is, cause me to get this measurement outcome at some point in the future. Basically, yes. Okay, so having spent 20 minutes setting everything up, now let me spend the rest of the time giving you concrete examples. The first example that I want to give demonstrates coherent measurements. So here's a little problem for you. I want you to decide whether the n spin 1/2 particles in this sack that I have here were prepared in the quantum state psi or phi. And I'm not ascribing any particular reality or interpretation of the quantum states here. I'm doing a fairly basic quantum mechanics problem, and I'm happy to adopt an essentially Fuchsian view here that, that really all of this quantum mechanics is just about making good decisions and predicting what I'm going to observe. And I think that that's sufficient to analyze this example. No. Each individual qubit here is prepared in psi, or each individual qubit is prepared in phi. These are the two possibilities, and you have to decide between them. So really, I'm talking about psi to the tensor n and phi to the tensor n. So there's a classical analog to this, particularly if you believe that quantum states are analogous to probability distributions, which is distinguishing between classical probability distributions P and Q. These were selected from an ensemble described by P. These were selected from an ensemble described by Q. And it is sufficient to solve this problem to look at them one at a time in succession and then just take a majority vote. So I bring in some sort of a classical measuring apparatus like a thermometer, and then I move this thing over and I measure them one at a time. If they were quantum, then they would collapse as I measured them, and I would extract information, and at the end of the day, I'd have a sequence of measurement outcomes, and then I would just do majority voting, right? Which, did I get more that indicated psi, or P, more that indicated phi, or Q? But what's interesting is that in the quantum case, this is not optimal. This is not the best way to do it. You can't do it this way. The optimal solution, the best probability of guessing correctly, involves a joint measurement on all n of them. And this is ridiculously difficult to do if n is large. You have to build some apparatus that, you know, does something to all of them at once. And so by and large, when we look at this in information theory, we say, okay, that's the theoretical upper bound, but screw it, we're not going to accomplish that. On the other hand, here's a way that you could accomplish that. If you had a quantum computer, then you could solve this problem with one-at-a-time interactions. And so here's my quantum computer. It's got quite a large quantum memory. It's got some kind of an input-output device here, a quantum probe, if you will. And solving this problem is now sort of trivial, because I just move my quantum computer over, and it sucks up all the qubits, stores them in its memory, and then at the end of the day, it does some joint measurement, which quantum computers can do, on its own memory, and it makes the optimal decision. Of course, this is cheating, right? I have to build the bloody quantum computer in order to do this, and so I haven't made this easier at all. So this is not a good solution, but if I think about this idea of a quantum computer with an input-output device that can talk to the qubits maybe just one at a time, right? The I/O bus is limited. You can only look at them one at a time. I could ask, can I do this in a way that's not cheating? Could I do this with a smaller quantum computer that has less than n qubits of memory? Could I do this with n over 2 qubits of memory? Could I do this with square root of n, or maybe even log n qubits of memory? So if I had more time, I would let you stew on that and take a poll. But instead, I'm going to tell you that, yes, it turns out that just one qubit of memory is sufficient. And now we're talking about things that are current technology that people have been playing with for the last 10 years. Let me show you how to do this. Here is your one-qubit quantum computer. It's just a single spin 1/2 particle in a Faraday cage, and it's got an I/O bus. It's got a way of interacting with other spins. And I'm going to... the idea behind this moment of technicality here is that the span of the two states I'm trying to distinguish, psi to the tensor n and phi to the tensor n, is just a two-dimensional Hilbert space. That's really all that I need to decide perfectly between them. The rest of the Hilbert space is irrelevant. And so what I need to do is to rotate that two-dimensional Hilbert space into my quantum memory. And it turns out that I can do this by applying a unitary between the memory and the first qubit. And what that unitary does is it doesn't suck the qubit in, but it does slurp out all the information about whether it was psi or phi. Actually, in this case, it basically does a swap, so it sucks the qubit in. But then I move on to my next, and I'll leave this qubit in a pure state that doesn't depend on what its initial state was. So I've sucked out all the information. Did I hear a question? Okay. Oh, yes, you do. I was sort of hoping nobody would bring this up. Let me actually finish the slide and then address that question. I'm going to address it if somebody brings it up, and I will. So what we do here is, at each step, I perform a unitary that rotates psi to the tensor little n, which is how many qubits I've looked at so far, into my quantum memory. And so I move along. It's actually a different unitary at every stage, but it changes in a very predictable way. You can run this with a fairly simple device, and it just goes along, and it keeps slurping all the information about whether that qubit was in psi or phi into your quantum memory. So now what we have is we have a little itty-bitty current technology device that can perform a joint measurement and make the best possible guess as to whether it was psi or phi. But in order to do so, it needs to look, and it can do these by looking one at a time, which is something that we couldn't do classically except for what Steve said. In order to do this, it has to interact unitarily with each qubit. But this isn't really a shocker, because a common model in quantum measurement theory of a quantum measurement is a unitary interaction between the apparatus and the system, followed by some kind of amplification, decoherence, collapse process. We pretty much understand the amplification. We moderately understand the decoherence bit. I personally don't understand the collapse at all. I can tell you why the state ends up being a statistical mixture of two outcomes. Oh, I'm sorry. I can tell you why the state ends up being describable as a statistical mixture of two definite outcomes. But I cannot tell you why one of them definitely happens. So since I don't understand that, I'm going to take it away. And I'm going to say, fine, this is a coherent measurement. It should be very uncontroversial, because all I did is I dumped the collapse bit, right? You interact unitarily, where U is this little quantum agent, with the system. As a result, you maybe get some knowledge. What kind of knowledge did you get? The proof of the pudding is in the eating. It's in how well you accomplish some task, and that's what I want to move on to next, except that I want to come back and address Steve's question. So, Steve, you're right. It's been shown 4 years ago that you can match the success probability of that joint measurement using a local adaptive measurement. So I gave this example because it's the simplest. You can match the success probability, but you are not making the same measurement. And the reason that this is apparent is that once you've slurped all the information out using our protocol, you can then decide what aspect of the question you want to address. Do you want to make a minimum error measurement, an unambiguous discrimination measurement? What are the prior probabilities that you assign to psi and phi? The entire adaptive scheme depends on those peripherals. And so that's the difference between our scheme. It's doing something different, which can be matched by a very special classical algorithm. So I just told you the proof of the pudding is in the eating, and if you're skeptical, you can say, well, I don't think your pudding is any better than a classical pudding, because it sounds like it tastes exactly the same, or just as good. So let me move on. There are slide numbers in the upper right. I'm going to ask those of you who have questions to just write down the slide number where you wanted to ask the question, and let me bulldoze on and leave the full 15 minutes at the end for discussion if I can. So this is a coherent measurement. It's something that a quantum agent can do. and it might be useful. A coherent measurement would give you, presumably, some kind of knowledge or information. What would it give you? I'm going to argue that it gives you something I call quantum knowledge. First skeptical question, don't you just mean quantum information? I define knowledge before as a resource that has units of information, so in that sense the answer is yes, but it has a purpose. Information is abstract. I'm going to be very specific about what my purpose is. I want to show you a task that you can win, that you can accomplish better with quantum knowledge. And the task is going to be betting. So why am I going to talk about betting? Well, if you're one of the radical Bayesians in the audience, then the question is, why would you talk about anything besides betting? But for those of you who are not radical Bayesians, the whole point of a measurement is to give me knowledge, which it has to have some use. What use is it? Well, if I have knowledge, if I have information, I should be able to predict things better. How do I tell whether I'm predicting things better? Well, you could force me to bet on the outcomes that I am predicting. And then you could see how often I win the bets. And in fact, there is a deep and extensive literature in probability theory and also in statistics about interpreting probability in terms of bets and also in terms of measuring statistical quantities using simulated betting schemes. So that's my surface overview of why I'm interested in betting. And if I can make a better measurement, a coherent measurement, it should give me better knowledge, and that should be evident in that it lets me win more bets. So, let's make some bets. I bring back my bag of spins. This time, they are all prepared in the same pure state, but you have no idea what that pure state is. And I ask you to watch me pluck one out, and then you get to pick a two-outcome projective measurement. Projective means repeatable operationally. And we're going to bet on the outcome. Plain old classical bets here, even odds. And the question is, how often can you win this bet? You pick the measurement. Okay, if you've thought about that a moment, the answer is you can win this bet 50% of the time and no better. And the reason is that your knowledge of the qubit is totally unitarily invariant, so you might as well just bet on the outcome of a sigma z measurement. Sigma x is the same thing. And the state is totally random with respect to that basis, so you win half the time. And since we're betting at even odds, you throw up your hands and say, you're wasting my time, and you go home. Well, I'm sad that you went home. I want to keep playing this game, so I'm going to sweeten the pot. I'm going to give you a little bit of an advantage. Same game. I'm going to pluck one out, we pick a two-outcome measurement, et cetera. But this time, I'm going to give you a test sample, and I'm going to let you measure that to get some information. And then you can use that information to inform your bet. So without loss of generality, to skip over stuff, you might as well measure sigma z because of unitary invariance. And without loss of generality, let me assume that you get up. And then you can make your bet. And how often can you win this bet? The answer turns out to be two-thirds of the time. So this is better, and now it's worth your while to play this game. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, but your expected utility is greater than zero. Now, the question I want to ask you is, could you do better than this? Can you win this game more often? Could you win this game all the time? Of course, obviously, I wouldn't be asking the question if the answer wasn't yes in some clever way, so fine, let's get through the clever stuff. Yes. I'm going to ask you, what axis do you want to measure along? And you could tell me a direction. You could send me a bunch of real numbers describing an orientation in three space with respect to, I don't know, the gravitational up and down, blah, blah, blah. You need a reference frame here to define, you know, which direction you're going to measure along. Or you could just send me over a big gyroscope pointing in some direction, and I could measure along that. That would be your reference frame. Or you could just send me back the test qubit and say, measure along this direction. Well, measuring along the direction of the test qubit is equivalent to saying, are they lined up or not? Is their total angular momentum 1 or 0? Well, you always win this bet, because they're both prepared in the same pure state, and so they are in the triplet, not the singlet. For those of you who understood what I just said, group the representation theory of SU2 is going to show up in a couple of minutes, so start reviewing it in your head. The reason you win this bet has to do with SU2 representation theory, and it's that even though if I measure this, I cannot guarantee that the second one that I bet on will be pointing in the same direction as I measured it in, I can guarantee that they will be, quote, pointing in the same direction, unquote, in the sense that their angular momentum will add up coherently. And the technical analysis comes out of the representation theory of SU2. So the point here is that the test sample contains useful information. It contains knowledge. It's a resource that you can use to win bets. And one thing you could do with that is you could observe it, and you could store the result in your brain. So here we go. Oops, you observed it, you collapsed it, you stored the classical result in your brain. You got up. And then you could use that result, and you could actually do something to make a bet. You send the reference frame back. But you converted quantum information down to classical information. This introduced error, and so you don't always win the bet. So if you really want to do a good job, and you can, which you can't, you would simply store and use it directly. In order to do so, you would have to have a Faraday cage implanted in your brain. Actually, you wouldn't have to have it in your brain. But if I want to argue that this is knowledge, you might say, well, knowledge lives in my head, right? Fine. Get the Faraday cage implanted, then you can store the spin in your head. Kind of stupid, I know, but I wanted to kind of demonstrate you could do that if you were willing to have major surgery. So, in this case, here's your Faraday cage. Sorry about the left half of your brain. And there we go. I just learned something. Oh, and now I'm going to use my knowledge. Okay, and now I bet on the angular momentum. So, this is quantum knowledge. I don't think we can make use of it, because we don't have Faraday cages in our heads, and even if we did, it would decohere on its way out there. But one interesting property is that quantum knowledge is absolutely not shareable. Big difference from classical knowledge. If you wrote a paper about quantum knowledge, you couldn't publish it. If you did publish it, it would become a classical paper. Well, you could write, I do plan to write a paper about quantum knowledge, but you couldn't write a quantum paper about quantum knowledge. So you can use it, but you can't share it with your friends. If you do, you're trying to clone it, and the result of cloning it enough times is classicality. And that, in a nutshell, is the entire point of this tiresome quantum Darwinism program that Wojciech and I spent years on. Okay, now I've given you the two ingredients. Mr. Chairman, how many minutes do I have left? Sorry? A little over five. So in 5 minutes, I'm going to try to give you a full-blown quantum agent. If you've hung on this long, prepare your fingernails. In the little over, I'm going to tell you what the point is. So, deep breath. I'm going to talk about adaptive quantum data compression. And this really is a hardcore quantum information result, which is currently in the last stages of being written up, so don't look on the archive. Why am I going to talk about data compression at all? For essentially the same reason I just talked about betting. Because it's a nice paradigm for learning and decision-making. The previous examples are toys. The first one had no real task. The second one had no real information gathering, just a task. I want an example of a real rich quantum agent, and I'm going to focus on data compression because it's like a cancer. It seeps into all kinds of cool areas of science. It's related to prediction. It's related to learning. It's related to error correction, which is why we can function. Von Neumann wrote the original paper on fault-tolerant computer design way back when. It's a classic. And he called it something like, on the synthesis of reliable organisms. Wonder what he was thinking about. And it's related, interestingly, for those of you who like thermodynamics, to refrigeration. Compression is basically about pumping entropy around, pumping it into places that you want it and pumping it out of places that you don't want it. So, the whirlwind tour of classical data compression. The idea of classical data compression is to take a long string in which the digits are not uniformly randomly distributed and therefore do not have maximal entropy, and compress it down into a much shorter string where the digits do have maximum entropy. And I want to emphasize one thing here. We usually think of this as going from a long string to a shorter string, and so this would have been a smaller box. But you typically don't actually get rid of physical information-carrying systems. They're still floating around. they're just all prepared in some very predictable ground state. They're still there. And so this is the sense in which data compression is more powerful than just an information theoretic task, that because you extracted all the information, all the entropy, into the beginning of this string, you now have a whole bunch of bits floating around that are very predictable and can be used. So the basic idea here is to replace common symbols like zero with very short code words and infrequent symbols with long code words. The compressed data has maximal entropy and the freed up space is highly predictable. And there's a beautiful result due to Shannon that the optimal compression map, optimal compression algorithm, will map n bits into n h of p bits, where p is the probability distribution governing the source of these assumed to be randomly selected from some distribution bits. And h here is the entropy function. In this case, for this distribution, the entropy is 0.47, so that's why I've compressed 100 bits to 47 bits. And doing this requires that you know what the distribution is, so that you know which symbols are more probable. So what do you do if you don't know what the distribution is, which is, by and large, always the case? Well, easy. Actually, not easy, but you build a machine that learns the probabilities as it reads them in. It reads in a stream of data, and it learns from the data, and it simultaneously compresses that data and spits it out as a shorter, more random string. And it's always compressing based on its best guess so far. This is called adaptive compression. So adaptive compression is, in my opinion, a really beautiful area of theory because it is the basic model for machine learning. It's the simplest, most tractable model of actually learning something non-trivial, which is that source distribution that generated those symbols. It's all about prediction. And the optimal adaptive algorithm for data compression compresses n bits to n h of p, that's the Shannon bound, plus some wasted, it wastes some space because it has to learn as it goes along. It doesn't know everything perfectly. You know, it's like an undergraduate, right? They waste time when they're doing their homework problems, whereas the professor could do them in a big hurry. But the undergraduate gets better and better and better and better until eventually the undergraduate is a professor. At least that's what we tell them. And the amount asymptotically that you waste is only logarithmic in the number of input bits. So this is a really good undergraduate. I mean, it doesn't waste very much time at all. Okay, so there's the background. Quantum data compression, for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to say it works basically the same way. There's all kinds of fidgety details that I don't want to talk about. Bits become qubits. Sets of strings become subspaces of Hilbert space. And the source probability distribution that we assume governs the input symbols becomes a source density matrix, which is the average state of all of the incoming qubits. Transformations now are done with unitary operations. You can do them in a quantum computer by building up those unitaries out of sets of quantum gates. And the biggest issue with this is that superpositions of input strings, which of course you have, because the whole point is to have quantum stuff here, get mapped to superpositions of output lengths. And this awkwardness, where is the end of the string? I don't know, it's a superposition, is why streaming quantum compression is relatively unexplored. So the penultimate punchline here is that we, by which I mean myself, Sarah Croak, and Dan Gottesman, recently worked out how to do streaming adaptive quantum data compression. This is a cartoon of how it works. You have an input stream of qubits, all of which are sampled from a totally unknown density matrix. And you have a small quantum information processor here, and it spits out two tapes, two streams of qubits. The compressed data comes out here. It's guaranteed to be maximally compressed. And pure qubits come out the other port. And this, I will state, is a useful resource for a living organism. Purity, lack of entropy, is very useful. And so why am I interested in data compression? I'm not really interested in data compression. I think the cool part of this is that this is an algorithm for distilling out very predictable things, right? You go to your house, you know where things will be. It's predictable. You wanted that. It's very useful. Okay, Owen is fidgeting here, so I need to finish up. So let me in a whirlwind, state how this works. And this is where those of you who've been hanging on by your fingernails are going to fall off. I'm sorry. The key to how this works is the Schur representation of a Hilbert space. We usually think of n spin 1/2 particles as a tensor product of a bunch of two-dimensional Hilbert spaces. And using group representation theory, you can decompose this in a very useful way by observing that the total angular momentum of all these qubits is invariant under permuting them, as is the direction of that angular momentum. And there's also a relational degree of freedom that basically says, what order did they come in? Are the first two aligned or anti-aligned? And that's invariant under rotating all of them simultaneously. Well, that's two groups. One is the permutation group SN, one is the SU2 rotation group. Apply a bunch of group representation theory, and what we find is that the Hilbert space breaks up as a direct sum, a bunch of subspaces, each of which factors into an irreducible representation of rotations and an irreducible representation of permutations, which is fancy language for this subsystem represents which direction the spins are pointing, by and large. And the other one represents what order they came in. This one is small, this one is big. We have a quantum algorithm that changes to this basis, and this is a brief statement of the algorithm that we came up with, and I will give you one fact about it, which is that it reads in these input qubits one at a time. It does a running Schur transform. It transforms them into this other representation, this other basis, where you have one subsystem that tells you about the overall direction of the qubits, right? The angular momentum vector, how long is it? Which direction is it pointing? That's basically the density matrix. That's all the information about the collective degrees of freedom of all those qubits. And the other register just stores the order. Almost all of the Hilbert space is in that register, and we dump it out after we compress it, because that register tells us nothing about the overall density, source density matrix. We keep the angular momentum registers around, and we use them in a way that I cannot possibly explain in 12 seconds. But we have to use them in order to compress this permutation register that we push out. And the point that I want to make here, the thing that I think is really cool that we didn't realize until after we'd written down this algorithm, is that the stuff that it keeps in its very small quantum memory, these are a quantum state estimate. It's like it was doing tomography to figure out what the source was, except it's not making any measurements. This is a totally unitary algorithm. It uses these registers exactly like you would use an estimate of the source density matrix. And it uses them to do something useful, which is to extract purity and compress data. And it does so in a way that is better, provably better than any other algorithm, especially classical algorithms that use tomography to find out what that source is. Okay. And let me state my conclusions. I think you've probably gotten an idea of where I'm going here. The new perspective on the quantum state. Mathematicians have been known to say that a state is a linear function on observables, and I interpret that to mean it's a mathematical device for assigning probabilities. Let me radicalize that a little bit. I ran this by Chris Fuchs the other day, and he didn't actively object. He was foaming at the mouth, so I don't know what that means. A quantum state for a system is a mathematical device that an agent uses to make good decisions about future interactions with that system. I take it that means I'm done? Our quantum states, even Chris's, are classical information stored in a classical brain. We write them down on paper, and they're extrapolated from classical data like tomography. That's how we write down these quantum states, right? We don't just pull them out of thin... I hope we don't pull them out of thin air. We have some data, right? Please tell me we have data. But an optimal quantum agent or quantum algorithm would use an entirely different quantum state. It's a quantum state in that it looks like a quantum state, it quacks like a quantum state, and it leaves quantum state poop all over the place, does the same thing. But it's weird. Thank you very much.
Dan went up first.
Yeah, for once I wanted to ask a question and get it answered. Can you go to transparency 30? I just want to make sure I understand. So yeah, it's around 30. In your first version of the game, maybe you should go just a little bit earlier to 28 or something. I'm not quite sure, Robin. But as I understand it, in the first version of the game, can you win this game? So you pick a two-outcome projective measurement.
No, you do.
Hmm? Who chooses the measurement?
You do.
I choose the measurement, two-outcome projective. I see, but there's no restriction there that it be a measurement on a single qubit. You're very careful in your wording. I just choose a two-outcome projective measurement, and since there's a qubit there, what else could I perform it on?
There's no such thing as a measurement on a single qubit. You have to have an apparatus. You have to have a reference frame. This is something that it took me a long time to learn, but thanks to Terry and Rob and Steve just repeatedly clubbing me over the head with it, what we do really is relational. I put you in floating in space, right? You're floating in space, there's no fixed stars, and I say measure this qubit in the sigma z basis.
Yes. But so there's an apparatus and there's one qubit. Now, in the second version of the game, there's an apparatus and there are two qubits. And you don't consider that a significant change.
You're missing the point. It's not that there's an apparatus, it's that there's a reference frame. Let's consider that to be external to the apparatus, right? I've got a Stern-Gerlach I can rotate in any direction. What direction do I rotate it in? You need to tell me what direction you want me to measure in.
So we have a direction, we have a Stern-Gerlach device, and we have a qubit.
Yep.
Okay. And in the second version of the game, we have an apparatus and two qubits.
But the first qubit, you're going to measure and collapse and throw away. You're just going to measure.
Okay. In the third version of the game.
Yes.
In the third version of the game, we have an apparatus and two qubits.
But
okay,
the second
in the first
qubit,
version of the game, we have direction, we have apparatus, we have one qubit.
Yep.
And by the time we get to the third version, we have apparatus and two qubits.
You have a direction, an apparatus, and a qubit. That's the direction. Information is physical. You want to
the
tell
main
me a
thing
direction?
I was asking this question for was just to try to check whether you were changing the rules of the game as you went through the three different versions.
And you should. And it's a great question, right? I mean, I hope that somebody out there learned something because that's exactly the question I wanted you to ask. Yes, it looks like I'm cheating. But you have to have a direction. And how can I give you a direction except by passing you a reference frame? I just used a quantum reference frame.
Thank you for an enjoyable talk. My slide is 23, number 23.
This will be quicker. Yes.
23.
I'm so sorry.
You can scroll because your conclusion is that there is no, in a sense, no collapse at the end.
Sorry, unfortunately we
But the question I can pose without that. So the whole this measurement is actually the distinguishment. You try to distinguish between two states that at least in the limit of n goes to infinity are almost orthogonal. So in that sense, the measurement is a classical measurement for which we do not really need the collapse.
The joint measurement is we might describe it as a classical measurement in the n goes to infinity limit. But I am not interested in the n goes to infinity limit because in the n goes to infinity limit, even a retarded monkey could make the right decision by making very bad measurements, right? I mean, you always win if you have infinite data. So I'm interested in the intermediate regime where one-at-a-time classical measurements are not as good as joint measurements, modulo the point that Steve made.
Then there will remain certain amount of collapse at the end if you're in the finite regime.
There will remain a certain amount of what?
It will be a collapse then in a finite regime.
Oh, so in this example, at the end of the day, if I do this, I am going to measure my one-qubit quantum agent. And this is a manifestation of the fact that I have no idea how to get out of the classical. I mean, my quantum mechanics is just a prediction of what I will observe, right? I'm trapped in that. I have no way to get out of that. And so, yes, at the end of the day, I have to collapse. I have to say what I'm going to measure about something. If I'm going to keep Chris happy by implying that quantum mechanics is not necessarily any more than a prediction of what I'm going to observe. But even within that, what I'm trying to convince you is that even just based on what you observe, you could observe something that would prove to you that what you were observing wasn't real, if that makes any sense. But I can't get out of that box.
Hi, Howard Wiseman. Just first a quick comment on exactly this example. You may have reasons you don't want to do this, but if you wanted to get around Steve's objection, all you have to do is change your pure states into mixed states, and then, there's the potential to do better using a quantum processor than with not a quantum processor, yes?
Can I, just a quick answer to that? First point, we would then need a log n-sized quantum processor, and nobody knows how to do interesting, the optimal solutions are generally not known, so it'd be hard to prove that we were better.
Yeah, for finite n, though, for some fixed small n, it would obviously be possible to work out what you could do, even with any given size. Anyway, but that's just a comment. You're obviously aware of that anyway. But the more interesting comment or question I wanted to make is, so you talk about being in the matrix and evidence of superpowers. It seems to me that that's exactly the situation we're already in. We have violations of Bell inequalities in the world. To me, that looks like evidence for superpowers. Now, you can either take the attitude like Chris or Rudiger and say, those superpowers don't impress me. Or you could say, shit, we're in the matrix. You know, what's it really made of? And I think that's what a lot of us, that's, you know, the attitude a lot of us have. So, comment.
Masterful. If you already adopt that perspective, then all I have to say is to point out that if you follow that line of thought along in the way that I have, that Shor's algorithm and Bell inequality violations are superpowers, then, and if you extend what quantum computers can do, not just to processing between classical inputs and classical outputs, but also to interacting directly with their environments, quantum robots, if you will, then I think it destabilizes the idea that events really happen. And I've seen a lot of talks here predicated on the one thing that we know is that events happen. Let's go from there. And if that's the one thing that we know, then I don't think we know anything. And I don't know where to go from there. I perceive them. I perceive those events to happen. And therefore, I will perceive narratives that are inconsistent with the assumption that events happen for everybody. If you're in a hallucination, you can't trust your senses, but you can still figure out that you're in a hallucination, right? When the elephants fly by, you could say, aha, I must be dreaming.
So, Robin, your talk leaves me with the impression that you don't want to allow that birds might be quantum robots.
Undecided.
What I mean by that is we know that there are quantum ways of doing certain metrological tasks better. So with a quantum reference frame, a quantum sample of a direction, you can measure the strength of a magnetic field better.
That's my quantum robot.
So you can measure the strength of the magnetic field, you can do phase estimation, you can measure gravitational fields better with quantum systems than you can with classical systems, and there's recently been some speculation that there's quantum coherence in the avian compass to explain how well birds navigate. And
you didn't use that example as a kind of quantum knowledge. So are you thinking that you should exclude that as quantum knowledge or not?
I'm thinking that A, I haven't read the papers. B, I don't think they're certain. And C, if you start talking about biological organisms that we interact with on an everyday basis using quantum effects, well, people look at you funny. I know I do. So I think it's fascinating. I have not thought deeply about it, and I only wanted to talk about things I have thought deeply about. But look, the example with the Faraday cage in your brain was silly, but not inconceivable, right? I mean, you could use quantum knowledge. Birds could use quantum knowledge conceivably, but I don't want to step out on a limb and say that they are, because I haven't read the papers.
It's a lovely talk, and I particularly admire you for the attempt. It's a lovely talk, and I particularly admire you for the attempt to design a quantum agent. But I want to focus on this design aspect. Suppose, 100 years from now, we've got quantum computers that are really humming, and you've implemented your adaptive quantum data compression algorithm and used the information in the quantum computer to do all kinds of other neat stuff. Then I can see a natural perspective from which we humans would say, yeah, let's regard this thing as an agent. After all, it's accomplishing all these tasks so efficiently. But somebody else might say, well, you just made it. Whatever intentionality and agency it has is inherited from you, the maker. Now, I'm not sure I want to go that way, but what I do want to suggest is that it's not an accident that agents have evolved in this decoherent world. If the world were not decoherent, there would be no possibility of agents like us making ersatz agents by designing quantum computers. So decoherence is a pretty deep contingency here. If there were no decoherence, there'd be no agents.
My response is the same as it was to Howard, masterful. I only have one quibble, which is that I, at least, do not yet know or have any clue what natural processes, and particularly the development of complexity and or evolution, would look like, or whether it could exist, or what the hell would be going on in a decoherence-free universe. I really want to know, but look, somebody put up a quote earlier, 2 days ago, from Schrodinger, in which he said, well, this theory will have to do until we understand biology better. I'm not that patient. I started reading Daniel Dennett, and I got two-thirds of the way through his book on consciousness, and I said, this is fascinating, but it's clear to me that we don't understand consciousness yet well enough to figure out whether it has any relevance to the quantum measurement problem. So I'm trying to cut the Gordian knot. I'm trying to talk about itty-bitty toy systems, because I think if we have to understand the microscopic details of biology and evolution in order to solve quantum measurement, I'm going to be dead by then. So you're asking great questions. I just don't know the answers.
So do you suppose that the reason that we're not quantum critters ourselves is then we wouldn't be able to share information with each other?
I think that I'm now going off of my threshold for confidence. I speculate that the reason we are not quantum critters, the reason that we are classical critters who believe in events, who perceive events, is that it is not adaptive in our universe and our world and our environment to put the effort into doing coherent measurements and storing quantum knowledge, because it's bloody hard and doesn't get you that much of an advantage. The relationship to sharing information may or may not be more fundamental than that. In other words, I think that it's meaningless to say that in our universe that we're classical in order to share information, because I think there's a better reason, which is that quantum strategies are useless with this much crap going on. Now, if you go to a decoherence-free universe and you start trying to explore your questions and figure out what would happen, right? What would things evolve? I have no idea. Then you could ask which would be better for those critters. to interact quantumly or to be able to share their information. But for us, information sharing is a freebie because quantum is already useless for us.
Okay, one final question before lunch.
Oh, mine was just a silly point about the navigation of the birds. I mean, you can easily get rid of that problem by saying...
I'm sorry, I missed the first.
The bird's navigation kind of idea, the fact that it's using quantum effects. You could just as easily say that we're quantum critters because we're using quantum effects by not falling through the floor and pushing through walls because there's quantum electrodynamic effects. I mean, it doesn't have to be a weird and wacky explanation if it's true anyway. That's the only point.
And my response to that is that I hope when we go off to lunch that you and Speckens and I and anybody else who wants will continue to discuss that because it's fascinating. But I do want to throw out one cautionary comment, which is that, actually this is a story. Years ago when we were figuring out what to call the new APS topical group on quantum stuff, there was a lot of discussion about what do we call it. And somebody said, well, how about the APS topical group on quantum? And a lot of people pointed out that that includes everything. And we didn't want the string theorists and the condensed matter people and, God forbid, the plasma physicists showing up at our topical group meetings saying, we're quantum. So my favorite name, which we didn't adopt, does anybody know what we did adopt? Just quantum information? I thought it was something long and tedious, like quantum information and... Okay. So my favorite was the topical group on explicitly quantum physics. And I want to draw a line between explicitly quantum and de facto quantum. The fact that you don't fall through that is, yep, fine, it's due to quantum effects, but we don't perceive them in any way directly. Right? But I think that there are quantum effects that come closer and closer to impinging directly on our experience. And superfluid helium is an example, quantum computers are a prospective example, and this sort of thing is my attempt to get as brutally in your face as possible with experiencing the quantum world, given that you can't see the wave function.